You're listening to The Andy Finn Show, centrally located in America, on the TAFS Radio Network.
We are back on The Andy Finn Show on WEBR, and you can listen to archives of the show or my parody songs like the one you just heard at andyfinn.us, that's andyfinn.us. Today is June 18th, 2007, and on this day, the first telecast that was received from overseas, from England, was broadcast in the U.S. In 1959, that took place. That was broadcast on NBC TV. And also, in 1961, the last broadcast of Gunsmoke on CBS Radio. So this is kind of the time that we transitioned from radio being the medium for drama and serials to television being the media for drama and serials. And so Gunsmoke appeared on television after that. And that all took place right around 1960. It's also the birthday of Roger Ebert. Film critic. Let me go on to an interesting piece that caught my eye in yesterday or the weekend's Washington Post. And it's interesting, but it basically is about the fact that we can't say, I don't know. And by we, I mean people in general, but men in particular. Of course, it was Father's Day weekend, Father's Day yesterday, and so happy Father's Day to everybody who is a father, if you're doing right by your kids, that is. But it was interesting because what this talked about was people at the Air and Space Museum, among other places, but a technology museum like that is one of the best, and the kinds of things that they've heard fathers explain to their sons, and people get it wrong all the time. And so it turns out that a lot of fathers are out with their sons, and the kid could be 4 or he could be 14, and they can't bring themselves to admit they don't actually know the answer to the kid's question. And so one example was a 12-year-old son asked his father, what is the dark discs made of on the Mercury capsule? And he said, steel. Well, actually, they're made from a plastic and fiberglass composite, according to the people at the museum. But it didn't occur to the father to just say, I don't know, or to say, let's check and look it up, right, and make it into like a science program. He made it up. And so a few of these fathers were asked about that. You know, hey, you seem to be making stuff up, and here's a quote from one of them. Now that I think about it, I guess I make up stuff all the time, he said. And he was at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial with his son, and they said, and his son asked him, how are bronze statues made? And he made up an explanation. He said, it was a total BS moment, but you've got to be the guy who has the answers, right? It's a habit. What should I say? That I'm 51 years old and I used to know this 20 years ago? That's not much of an answer. I'm sorry, I don't know about the rest of you and whether you're able to say I don't know, but I teach college students for a living, and you've got to be able to say, I don't know. Now, I can always say, I have a follow-up, but I'll often start with, well, I don't know for sure, or I don't know what the research says, or I don't know what this particular author would say, or this particular study shows, but in general, and then I can expand on it and say something about the topic. Right? Or if I don't know, I can always turn it back to the students. Now, that might not work so well for a father and his son, but you can turn it into a learning moment and say, I don't know, let's look it up, or let's ask the guard in the museum. It is just amazing, and this seems to be it's a habit that infects talk radio. I'm listening to people. I listen to quite a bit of talk radio, both the left and the right, and you very rarely hear anybody say, they don't know the answer to something. All these people, it's mostly guys, but all these guys and girls are just so sure of their opinions. They're like, oh, well, this is the way that is, as though it's fact. It's really quite a strange phenomenon. I still remember years ago when I was listening to Rush Limbaugh, and this must go back to like 1998. I'm driving along one day, and he's talking about the internet and how amazing it is that he's got a website now, and it's going to be one of the best websites and all this stuff. And he says, nobody knows where the internet came from. And I'm sitting there thinking, nobody knows? What are you talking about? What he meant to say is, I don't know where the internet came from. But he assumed that since he didn't know, nobody knows. Now, of course, at the time, I'd been teaching technology courses and teaching courses about the internet for several years. And so I just thought it was hilarious that since Rush didn't know where the internet came from, he assumed nobody knew. If he didn't have the answer, nobody does. So I'll call this the Rush Limbaugh phenomenon. But there's a lot of fathers out there, apparently, and women do it too to some extent, but not as much as men. And men tend to do it more when they're talking about technology issues. And so it's just interesting to think about this, that we people tend to make up stuff instead of just saying, I don't know, let's check it out, let's look it up. It's just strange. And one of the arguments put forward in the article by some of the fathers, I don't quite buy. They're claiming that the museums are intimidating because they have so much information in them and they have this mantle of authority. And so parents feel foolish when they're in museums because there's so much information they should know. No, teach your children that the world is complex and that there aren't easy answers to a lot of questions. I mean, there are factual answers, but no one person knows all the factual answers. Instead, people just act as though, oh, the world's knowledge is easy to master. See, I know it all. That is the Rush Limbaugh effect. And let me tell you, it doesn't work out so well for him because he has a huge audience, but he misleads them all the time. And again, this kind of takes me to the next segment and the politics and the other issues we're going to talk about tonight. Because I've said at the beginning, we're going to talk about two cognitive processes, perspective and selective attention. And I guess I also want to talk about perception. Both of these are aspects of perception. So let's start with perspective. People who listen to the show know that the Andy Finn Show is about 20 percenters. In large part, when we start talking about politics, when we start talking about people's viewpoints, we're talking about 20 percenters. And my theory is that it's the 20% of the people on the far right and the 20% on the far left that are ruining this country for the rest of us. Do you know what I mean? If you are a 20%er, that is, if you are in the 20% of the population that's at one extreme or the other, you have a skewed view of the world. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not a 20%er myself. I'm left of center, but I'm in that 30% that is left of center, but not out on the extreme 20%. And I also believe that if you're in that 30% on the left or 30% on the right that's nearest the center, you have more in common with the people just on the other side of center from you, right or left, than you do with the extremes on your own side. I have more in common in many ways with the moderates who are right of center than I do with the ultra-liberal folks. And part of it is perspective. Okay, if you think of this as paradigms, worldviews, or the lenses that you have on. If you put on a pair of conservative lenses, you interpret every piece of information that comes into you through a conservative filter. And if same with liberals. If you put on liberal lenses, you filter everything through liberal filter. Now, since I'm left of center, I'm aware that I filter things through a liberal lens. So I try and catch myself, and I try not to be too partisan or too partial. You know, I think my viewpoint's right, but I'm willing to listen to other points of view because I'm well aware I could be mistaken. You don't hear that kind of talk from 20 percenters. Okay. And what's interesting is the 20 percenters are driven crazy by the people on the opposite side. Rush Limbaugh doesn't realize that Michael Moore is his mirror image. Right? The people that talk about Michael Moore, the Bill O'Reillys of the world, the Sean Hannitys, the Rush Limbaughs, they argue that he's insane is one thing you hear, is that the people on the opposite side from them are insane. Also that they're dumb, that they're naive, that they're ignorant, that they don't know what's going on, that they only have half a brain, however it is they put it. It's really interesting, but they cannot wrap their head around the viewpoint from the other extreme. And so for me, it comes down to the fact that when your view is so skewed on the far right or the far left, the people at the opposite end of the spectrum, it's like they're from another planet. Whereas if you're closer to the center, if you're in that 60% that are in the center, you can look at the extreme right and you can look at the extreme left and you can see their mistakes, you can see their biases, you can see where their perceptions are warped, and you can poke holes in their arguments. So I read a bunch of different blogs and I listen to a bunch of talk radio and I listen to cable news shows. I listen to the liberal shows on MSNBC. Primarily among that would be Keith Olbermann's show, which is left to center, his viewpoint. And I listen to the conservative shows on Fox Radio, Hannity and Combs. By the way, for those of you that think that show's fair and balanced, think Harlem Globetrotters is Hannity and Washington Generals, that's Alan Combs. They let him play, but his job is to lose. And I listen to, Bill O'Reilly. I watch a little bit of him. Watch a little bit of the earlier shows on Fox, both, you know, Brit Hume's show at 6, but also the two that come before that. And, you know, they stack the deck in favor of conservatism in the same way that Keith Olbermann stacks his show in favor of liberals. Also, talk radio, same kind of a thing. I listen to a little bit of Air America. I don't really need to have my left of center views confirmed, so I don't actually listen to them too much. I don't think they're particularly good. I listen to the far right radio, not because they're any better, but because I like to know what arguments they're putting out there, because their audiences are so much larger. Conservatives or people like Rush Limbaugh, talk show hosts, like to point to that and say that somehow large audiences prove the value or the validity of their viewpoints. Actually, there's another way to look at that. There's another reason why far-right radio doesn't draw big audiences. And Rush Limbaugh would say two things. One, you've already got far-right media, the news, the networks, and all the mainstream media, which of course is nonsense. We've talked about that before. Media are by definition conservative. That is, they want to keep the status quo in large part, although the job of the Fourth Estate is to find fault with the current power structure. But the second thing is, the Rush Limbaughs of the world would argue, they do argue, that liberal positions don't have truth on their side, so naturally people aren't going to listen to them. Well, the flaw in that argument is this. If ratings alone determine quality, then that makes Howard Stern the best guy at radio. And yet, if you listen to his stuff, you know that he's a juvenile. He's a 16-year-old kid in a 40-something, 50-something-year-old body who thinks that talking about poo-poo and caca is funny, and that having women come on and kiss each other and take off their clothes on radio, mind you, is great radio. Now, he gets ratings for doing that stuff, so I guess it is, quote, great radio, but it just means it's least common denominator programming. You can get a wide circle of people to listen to that. He's authentic. He's a 16-year-old kid that never grew up, and he doesn't seem at all troubled by that, and so he makes millions being himself. Well, I think it's the same with Rush Limbaugh. as opposed to, let's say, Ed Schultz or Tom Hartman on Air America. There's a big audience for what Rush does. He validates the prejudices that people already have. You know, he has this very skewed view of the world that doesn't have much relationship to reality, but he gets 20 million people a week that listen to him. And so they want their view of the world, warped though it is, to be validated, and somebody to say that these other people are crazy, science is crazy, and the mainstream media are crazy, and everything's going well in Iraq, and all of that stuff. Whereas on the left, the fact that Air America isn't taken off is actually a little reassuring to me. I don't think we have as many gullible people on the left, or certainly not people that want their opinions validated constantly. Now, you go to the blog world, and there's a bigger group of them on blogs. But there they get to express their own opinions, not just listen to somebody rant. And so you get some pretty wild opinions. You get conspiracy theories from 20 percenters, both on the right and the left. And there's a whole bunch of people on the far left in the blogosphere that are get a little carried away and overstate the arguments wildly in the same way conservatives do. But that's just what 20 percenters do. So the first thing is perspective. What is, you know, what's your perspective on things? And the second thing that I want to talk about is selective attention. What do you actually focus on when you're given a chance to cover events? Whether you're in the blogosphere, you're on talk radio, or you're on television news, cable network news, or the networks. And it's really instructive to watch that stuff. I will, when a news story comes on, breaks, I flip the channel around so I can see how different networks and shows are covering it. For example, if you watch Fox News at all and you attend to what they cover, you know that they don't cover a lot of international news. Okay, CNN covers a lot of international news. MSNBC, not so much. But Fox News, and this is mostly the evening shows from about 4 p.m. through 10 p.m., even 11 p.m. Yeah, 11 p.m., let's say, the end of prime time. They cover a lot of fluff. Okay, now they like to brag they have the highest ratings. It's the most trusted name in news. But much of what they cover in those hours is not news. In fact, Brit Hume's show from 6 to 7 p.m. is the only hour that is straight news. Right? He's selective in what he covers, but it's straight news. He's not, oh, Paris Hilton would have to be big in the news for them to cover Paris, much the way in Hardball. Chris Matthews won't even go on the air if they are going to insist on covering some missing white woman or Paris Hilton. Somebody else covers it, and they don't call it Hardball yet. He just won't do that stuff. And Hume is kind of in the same category. Occasionally, each of them has to do a few minutes on somebody like Paris because it's such a big story that day. But John Gibson with My Word, I think that's on at 5 o'clock. Shepard Smith's show that's on before that. Bill O'Reilly at 8 o'clock. These folks are covering all the titillation. They are covering, you know, sexy models, and they're covering Hollywood stories. And they're always looking for light, fluffy stories. But then what's interesting is that when they decide they want to do hard news, they turn around and they do a commentary. You know, they do a couple of news pieces, but then they'll do a commentary about Iraq or about immigration or something, as though they are some kind of a pundit, when in fact what they do mostly is cover fluff. Anyway, that's the other thing about Fox News, besides not covering international news. So when I talk about selective attention, that's one piece of it. And, of course, there are fluff shows on MSNBC and CNN, too. A CNN headline has Nancy Grace, right? She and Greta Van Susteren on Fox, and one of the shows on MSNBC, I can't think which one, late at night, all cover fluff. That's what they do for an hour. It's fluff. But the other piece about selective attention is when a legitimate news story comes up, who covers it and how much time do they spend covering it? And when we come back, we're going to talk about that.
Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to The Andy Finn Show.
The smooth talk of the town.
Cool. Well, all right. We are back on The Andy Finn Show on WEBR Radio. And today is June 18th. On this day, in 1979, Leonid Brezhnev and Jimmy Carter signed the SALT II, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, the second one, in Vienna. And today's the birthday of Lou Brock, famous baseball player and base stealer. Boy, the stories I could tell you about Lou Brock. I won't go into it. Because we're talking about perspective, and we're talking about selective attention. So the other interesting thing about the difference in 20 percenters, or news from the right and news from the left, is this. Some stories don't even get covered. Some stories don't even get covered. All right, now I'll get to one of those in a minute. But the stories, when both sides do cover a story, it's interesting how different it is. Let's take the one that's been in the news for the last, better part of the last week. Middle of last week, or maybe it was Thursday, the judge in the Scooter Libby case let it be known that Libby would not be allowed to stay out of prison pending his appeal. He was going to have to serve his time. The judge didn't think there was a reasonable chance he'd get out of it. Now, that's pretty unusual in and of itself. Usually a white-collar crime, you're allowed to stay out of prison until your appeals are exhausted. But the judge, of course, I think is putting pressure on Libby in part because if he can drag this out a year, year and a half, Bush may pardon Libby Christmas of 08 after the election and as he's headed out of office. And he might not, but that's the thinking. But what's interesting is the view from the right and from the left on Scooter Libby. To a person, with one exception, Pat Buchanan, every conservative or Republican I saw interviewed felt either mildly or most of them felt strongly that Scooter Libby should be pardoned, that Scooter Libby was railroaded, that these charges should never have been brought against them, that he just misremembered things and we should have pity. Anybody can misremember, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's just really interesting to me that that's their view, because if you listen to people on the left, their argument is, hey, he was part of a plan with, along with Cheney and maybe Rove, to leak the name of a CIA agent just to embarrass Joe Wilson. And of course, there's all kinds of misinformation about there that, well, she wasn't really a CIA operative, an undercover, a covert operative, et cetera, et cetera. No, the people that have been following this are pretty clear about that. And the CIA is the one that said, please open an investigation. One of our agents has been outed. So no formal determination was ever made about that. But the really interesting thing is the difference between what the people on the right and the people on the left are saying about Libby. The argument you hear from conservatives is that there's no underlying crime here, and he just misremembered. It wasn't really perjury and obstruction of justice. And it's a travesty of justice, so Bush should pardon him. Well, of course, if you're wearing conservative lenses, you're not going to think Scooter Libby did much wrong. From the other point of view, though, people say, well, wait a minute. What are you talking about? Libby clearly lied. I mean, there's a string of lies here that he concocted a cover story that reporters told him about Valerie Plame. He didn't tell reporters. And yet we've got the original article from the New York Times, the Robert Novak column that Cheney wrote annotations in the margin about. He wanted this thing handled. He wanted something done. So Libby basically stonewalled the prosecutor, threw sand in the umpire's face, as Fitzgerald put it. And so he said, you know, this ain't fair. You can't be doing this. And he put the hammer down, and Libby's going to prison. What's interesting is the comparison with the impeachment of Bill Clinton. Because when these Republican and conservative speakers and pundits say, and the Republican candidates say that there was no underlying crime, so you shouldn't charge the guy with perjury. There was no there. Several of them have been reminded by questioners, well, how is this different from 1998? You supported the impeachment of Bill Clinton. There was no underlying crime there, right? There was an investigation, but he wasn't convicted of anything in that situation. And in fact, the prosecutor in the case, Ken Starr, already had all the facts. He knew about the Monica Lewinsky affair. And he set a trap for Clinton, and Clinton fell in it. But at the time, they were all very self-righteous about the rule of law, the rule of law. We must be a nation of laws. Now, to me, I'm in agreement with them about perjury and about the rule of law. They are arguing, many cases, the conservatives are arguing, oh, no, this is different. The Clinton thing was totally different. And people say, why? And then they hem and haw, and they can't explain why. They claim, well, it was a civil case or something like that. But the real difference doesn't support the conservative side. The real difference between the Scooter Libby situation and the Clinton situation is this. Clinton did commit perjury under oath, just as Libby did. And he may have obstructed justice, even as Libby may have obstructed justice. But you have to think twice about removing a president, because you are bringing down a government and you're overturning an election. Now, we were going to impeach Nixon in 74, and then he resigned. Okay, but he got caught with the goods. He had an enemies list. His people burglarized the headquarters of the opposition. They did other things. Very different kind of a situation. And so it's just interesting to see all the people that thought Clinton should be impeached over perjury, change the government, bring down the president, don't see it with Scooter Libby. Pardon him. So that's just one example. And the second example I want to use is an example of selective coverage. So let's use the Alberto Gonzalez firing the White House, I'm sorry, firing of the prosecutors scandal situation, whatever you want to call it. All right. I mean, this has been a hot topic in the news. And you wouldn't know it from watching Fox News or from listening to conservative talk radio. They don't talk about this much at all. Occasionally, they have to cover it on Fox. Britt Hume may cover it on his show or in his roundtable. And they're all agreed. They got a bunch of conservatives sitting around mostly, and maybe one token person from NPR that, you know, the implication is they're representing the liberal point of view, I suppose. But the conservatives are all in agreement that there's no there with the attorney scandal. Meanwhile, the other shoe keeps dropping every week. A fifth person has resigned from the White House. I'm sorry, from the Justice Department just last Friday. Michael Easton, who was the chief of staff for Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty, is the chief of staff, has decided to resign. That's five people under Alberto Gonzalez that have decided to resign in the midst of this whole thing. And so what's interesting is that the more the information that has come out, it's becoming very clear that there's been a politicization of the Justice Department and the appointments in the Justice Department. There are investigations going on about not just these nine fired prosecutors and how they got put on the list to be fired, because it was originally said it was performance, and now it's fairly clear it's not performance related. And it looks like all roads lead back to Karl Rove, but the White House is circling the wagons and doesn't want to say. But in addition to that, we've got the woman at GSA who was testifying last week, Doan, I think her name is. And she's claiming she was not doing anything political, but they did a PowerPoint presentation about the close Senate races around the country, and the ones where Republicans are in a fight. And then she said to the gathering, let's see how we can help our candidates. Well, that's a violation of the Hatch Act. but they seemed unaware of it at the time. And then Monica Goodling let it be known, I think it was her, that said that when it came to immigration judges, they were applying a litmus test. They were making sure they had good, solid Republicans, but they were also having those Republicans remove some of their Republican credentials from their resumes. So send me your resume, but take off the part about the fact that you're a member of the Federalist Society so that they look more impartial. And then there's the investigation in the Civil Rights Division. We knew back in 2004 that the career lawyers in the Civil Rights Division were complaining that their advice wasn't being listened to. They argued that the Tom DeLay's redistricting plan in Texas was a violation of civil rights because he was taking a predominantly black district and slicing it up. He mostly was interested not in discriminating against blacks, but in discriminating against Democrats. But the Civil Rights Division had a say in this, and the career lawyers were overruled by Bush political appointees, including the guy who's now Bush's appointed or wants to appoint to the Federal Election Commission. And the Democratic Senate has to decide if they're going to confirm him or not. A very partisan fellow. He worked on opposition research at the RNC. So it's becoming more and more clear the extent to which the Bush team up and down the line has wanted to change the face of Washington and of appointments by putting, you know, solidly conservative people in as many positions as possible. Now, people say, well, what do you mean the politicization of the Justice Department? You can't politicize the Justice Department. It is political. Well, up to a point. That argument is a little specious for this reason. You put the 93 prosecutors in place that you want, but most presidents don't then fire the ones that don't do their bidding. What that one has come down to is Karl Rove and company believe that they should have been more aggressive in looking at voter fraud, meaning cases where people register to vote and they aren't entitled to vote. Well, Republicans have long been interested in suppressing the vote. Democrats are usually interested in expanding the vote and getting higher turnout. All right, so it clearly is a political ploy, and they want to see those prosecutions instead of certain other kinds of prosecutions. Up to a point, a president gets his right to set his agenda, but you get to decide whether you want to focus on white-collar crime or violent crime, or you want to focus on, you know, A versus B. But it shouldn't be. We want to focus on the kinds of crimes that will help us elect more of our own. That's not quite the kind of impartial justice that we want. So back to coverage and selective attention. Shows like Hardball with Chris Matthews have been all over this because it's in the news and it's juicy and it's hardball politics. But most of the shows on Fox News have not touched this issue more than once or twice, you know, or maybe over the course of 4 or 5 months as it's broken. They've covered it more than that. But I watch a lot of coverage, and they are just staying away from it. So when we come back, I want to tell you something else they're staying away from, because there's a new article by Cy Hirsch in this week's New Yorker that is a bombshell, and yet I didn't see Britt Hume lead off with it tonight. Now, I didn't see his whole show tonight. This is the only real news show on Fox News all evening. I didn't actually see him cover it, and he might have because I didn't see the second half of his show, but I'm guessing he didn't even touch it. We'll be back.